Well, it's time to begin. It's March 15th, 1522 hours, daylight savings time. This is Ward Green, and I should say it's daylight savings time, but I'm in the Eastern time zone, just for clarity. So we came from Eastern Standard Time a few days ago. Now we're in daylight savings time. And this is the year 2023. It's March 15th, and I feel much better because I had 9 hours sleep last night. And I'm avoiding vitamin D. That's, for me, absolutely crucial. Crucial. And I'm also avoiding calcium because I did actually take an awful lot of vitamin D. And it was not without purpose. I wasn't doing it recklessly. I was taking it with vitamin K2, which is completely non-toxic, as far as we know, as far as is known to man, the least, possibly the least toxic substance known to man. I don't know, it's very non-toxic. So, and vitamin K2, it uses vitamin D, so it reduces the toxicity of vitamin D very much. That's why I could take so much vitamin D also. But I still have to assume that I've been poisoned. I'm not fully recovered, obviously. We all go through a tough time in the Northern Hemisphere during January and February because of the lack of sunshine also. But I didn't have any problems like I normally do in January and February. I had no problems at all during those months like I normally would and did have because of the lack of sun, because this year my vitamins were so, and my whole diet was so well organized, or it was well formulated by Jehovah's permission. I mean, he allowed me to eat better than I ever have with regard to vitamins, and as well as food, of course, but the vitamins are absolutely crucial, absolutely crucial. Now, today's study, we're about to finish the chapter 3 of The Wild Road Ahead to History, article part 1. That's exciting. That's very exciting for me. I know we're going to come into, I want to point out that some paragraph that I would recommend that you read, little children, is paragraph 4, 7, chapter 4, paragraph 7. Of this particular article, Wild Road Ahead to History, because in that chapter it mentions some interesting chronological realities, including the Jewish tradition of the ordinal and cardinal numbers in the Jewish language, which makes 400 years mean either, or I should say, it makes the fourth generation mean either 300 years, or assuming one generation equals 100 years, okay? Because Abraham was 100 when he had his first son. So a generation for Abraham was 100 years, because he was 100 years old at the birth of his first son. So assuming that the fourth generation is related to this 100 years, which makes sense, because Abraham was 100 years old when he generated his first son. Then the fourth generation could mean 300 years plus, or it could mean 400 years and then some. And the reason for the second definition of that 400 years, we're going to get into this in today's study anyway. But the second definition of the fourth generation, I should say, not the 400 years. The second definition of, there's also 400 years, but that's a different point. That's mentioned in the Bible also, 400 years. But the fourth generation is mentioned, and the fourth generation, it can also mean 400 years plus some. The reason for that is because in the Hebrew language, the ordinal numbers sometimes have the same import as cardinal numbers. So it's unclear whether it means 300 and something or 400 and something. And that's also demonstrated by the reality in the Hebrew language that all the ordinal numbers bigger than 10 have cardinal meanings. They don't have ordinal meanings, so they don't mean tenths, they mean 10 plus. All of the numbers after 10. So, you see, even that's unclear, because we don't know whether it starts with 11 or 10, because the Jewish language is that way. But it's not to be concerned. You see, the Jewish language didn't have to be that accurate. There's no language like the English language. The number of shades of meaning in the English language, or the number of words in the English language, far surpasses the Hebrew language, which doesn't make the Hebrew language any less respectable, or any less blessed, you know, or any less wonderful at all. But the Hebrew language, or I should say the English language, is indeed one that is capable, a language that's capable of many, many, many shades of meaning that other languages just don't achieve. So let's read paragraph 312, shall we? In the Wild Road article, Little Children. I was an old man during Tut's entire reign. And so he may have resumed the Amarna mode of reckoning upon the death of Tut. You know, maybe the saying old habits die hard might apply here. The likelihood of this being greater as the measures Horemheb took to erase Ai were extensive. Whether the story told by Manetho about Seti's return and his defeat of Armez referred to the continuation of the Passion 1 reckoning after Horemheb, or whether indeed Amarna's traditions vanished after Ai, remains to be seen. But Seti's lunar dates support the former. Tut, on the other hand, clearly returned to the former capital at Thebes and abandoned Amarna and its ritual. The definite year 9 wine label for Tut, combined with a death in January or February of 1348, based on Ai's year 3 May 22nd new moon, the date being a lunar day minus 1 Apaf 1, in 1347, based on that date of Ai's, it is in 1348 that Tut died. Interesting, because there's only a 1 year difference there, and we're talking about year 3, but we're also talking about the Passion Reckoning, which we saw before can lead to different year numbers. These things are determined, or this in particular, the definite year 9 wine label for Tut combined with the death in 1348, determined partly by the year 1, 1344 of Horemheb, or also it's determined partly by the 1341 year 1 of Horemheb, if that's his year 1, with greatest, though moderate, probability. It's still a moderate probability for Horemheb in 1344, but we've also come to believe that there might even be a greater probability for 1341. But this leads to a first wine in 1357 for King Tut, either way. And so 1357 to 1349, which is 8 years different, but 9 years inclusive, so 9 vintages, because there are 9 wine seasons included in those 9 years inclusive. So 9 wines. However, the 9 vintages, the few wine labels, however, for year 3 of the pharaoh preceding Tut suggests that Year 3 was also 1357 for those, whoever that person was. Or, as Krauss suggested, that the year change occurred during the bottling of the wine. Which is ruled out by 1359 being Akhenaten's last vintage. When the wines of the successors are determined from the time of the death of Akhenaten, that is, there are only 1358 and 1357, which are two, unless 1359 is a shared vintage, which no one attests. Akhenaten year 1 1375 BCE and Tut year 1 1357 BCE seem secure. And that's the end of chapter 3, which was entitled Proposing Amarna Calibrates Egyptian Seasons. So because we had some attempts at giving the years for Amarna, the years for the pharaohs, this is the proposals that we were making in this chapter. Those proposals calibrated the Egyptian seasons so as to imply that perhaps Paschen 1 was the beginning of the Egyptian official year during the time of Amarna, which idea came out of originality. It didn't come from other sources, that if I'm recalling correctly. There was no source. I didn't have a source to refer to with regard to Paschen 1 dating. It was my original research that led to this Jehovah revealing it to me, this revelation, I suppose you could say, which it was born out of necessity in order to account for the information that was available. But that's the end of chapter 3. Look at the beautiful pyramid and sphinx. So big we can't even... Okay, we can zoom down on it. We can zoom out. Oh, there we go. Let's zoom out and get a picture of it. It's just a beautiful picture. Is it not? Beautiful photograph of the pyramid at Giza and the famous Sphinx, which is associated with the dream stela of... The Sphinx is associated with the dream stela of Thutmose IV. There are many interesting stories in the Egyptian history, and we've covered a few of them now after finishing chapter 3 in today's study. So the next part of our study, I feel much more awake today than I did yesterday. That's an understatement perhaps, but I got 9 hours sleep last night, which is quite significant also. Now in our study for today in the book of Genesis, little children, Genesis chapter 15, it's rather an important study. And I want to preface it perhaps by saying that this appears to be the very first mention of Jehovah's promise to Abraham. Even though we know that Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 returned or came, it says there, to Canaan. But in the book of Jasher, he was returning to Canaan as described at the age of 75 in Genesis chapter 12. So if the book of Jasher be correct on this, then it's very possible that these other events occurred earlier in the life of Abram, including this chapter 15, which may in fact be the first time that Jehovah gave the promised land to Abram by establishing a covenant with him. So that's the context in which I would like to begin this chapter. And then this can be seen as part of a flashback, which included also the sojourn of Abraham into Egypt, or Abram as he was then called, and also the attack and the war or battle between Chedorlaomer, which also means Chedor of Lagomar, which whereby we get the name Gudea, because he was from the area of Lagomar. So Chedorlaomer can be seen to be Gudea, who was also called Ninus, who was the Assyrian founder of the Assyrian Empire, which we talk about in other articles, and we promise, we will hope certainly to get there and study those things in more detail. But Chedorlaomer was mentioned in chapter 14, as we read yesterday, and we've seen it, talked about it before. That battle was perhaps also part of this flashback, and then we go into the sojourn into Egypt, of course, which is talked about in the interim between 12 and chapter 12 and this chapter 15. That sojourn into Egypt also. I think it was chapter 13, but I haven't really. It was in chapter 12. And then he went up out of Egypt. All of that, chapter, the later part of chapter 12 and 13. So right from, he went out from Haran at the age of 75 in Genesis 12 and 4, did Abram. But that was perhaps his final move. According to the book of Jasher, that was not the first time that he went there. But if we look at chapter 10, it's interesting because there are several occurrences where Jehovah promises Abram that he's going to give him the promised land of Canaan. Genesis 12 and 7 is one of those instances. But if we just consider that to be more of a later summary of the events here, and it could have been that these events happened very early. All of these things that were said here, that he was promised these things, all of that he was promised the land of Canaan in chapter 12 there, that could have been the very earliest time that he was promised. But the fact that he was 75 might have been a later visit where he finally moved from Haran. So the age of 75 is to be considered as a very important fact, and that's why it was put first. But it may not have been the first thing that happened. So when we get to chapter 12, verse 10, when the famine arose, that could be the beginning of the flashback, really. Or at least, since the other portion refers to Abram's age as being 75, the rest of that paragraph, down to verse 9, we're not sure whether that's part of a flashback or whether that's part of a later occurrence in the account. So it looks like the famine arising in the land, under the idea of being consistent with the book of Jasher, this is an earlier occurrence before Abram was 75. Okay, so when we go over here, now we're in chapter 15, and we're going to understand, or perhaps we'll understand, whether this makes sense in the light of what it says in this chapter. So here we go. After these things, the word of Jehovah came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not fear, Abram. I am a shield for you." Your reward will be very great. At this, Abram said, "Sovereign Lord Jehovah, what will you give me, seeing that I am going childless, and the one who will possess my house is a man of Damascus, Eliezer?" And Abram added, "Look, you have given me no seed, and look, a son of my household is succeeding me as heir. But look, the word of Jehovah to him was in these words, 'This man will not succeed you as heir, but one who will come out of your own inward parts will succeed you as heir.' He now brought him outside and said, 'Look up, please, to the heavens and count the stars, if you are possibly able to count them.' And he went on to say to him, 'So your seed will become.' And he put faith in Jehovah, and he proceeded to count it to him as righteousness. Then he added to him, I am Jehovah, who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land, to take it in possession. To this he said, Sovereign Lord Jehovah, by what shall I know that I shall take it in possession? In turn he said to him, Take for me a 3-year-old heifer, and a 3-year-old she-goat, and a 3-year-old ram, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. So he took all these to himself, and cut them in two, and put each part of them so as to match the other. But the birds he did not cut in pieces, and the birds of prey began to descend upon the carcasses. But Abram kept driving them away. After a while, the sun was about to set, and a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And look, a frightfully great darkness was falling upon him. And he began to say to Abram, You may know for sure that your seed will become an alien resident in a land not theirs. And they will have to serve them, and these will certainly afflict them for 400 years. But the nation that they will serve, I am judging. And after that they will go out with many goods. As for you, you will go to your forefathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation they will return here, because the error of the Amorites has not yet come to completion. Your seed will become an alien resident in a land not theirs. Verse 13. The sun was now setting, and a dense darkness came. And look, a smoking furnace and a fiery torch that passed in between these pieces. On that day, Jehovah concluded with Abram a covenant, saying, To your seed I will give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Rephaim, and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites and the Jebusites. And that's the end of Genesis chapter 15. On that day Jehovah concluded with Abram a covenant. Genesis 15 and 18. So whether this happened very early on, at the time before Abram was 75, we shouldn't rule that out, certainly, as a possibility. Which would explain why Abram also may have had additional confidence in the promise that Jehovah gave him, which was mentioned in Genesis chapter 12 also, about the land of Canaan. Jehovah now appeared to Abram and said, To your seed I'm going to give this land, in Genesis 12 and 7. Now maybe that's referring to chapter 15, possibly. Maybe. See, but in chapter 15, I should say. Right. In chapter 15, in verse 7 again, same verse number, Jehovah said, I brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land. There's the promise again. So this could be the original event that's talked about in Genesis 12 and 7 at the time when Abram moved permanently from Haran. And that would be consistent with this too. So rather than having Jehovah promise more than once, or rather than there being that kind of repetition, which is not certainly not impossible, but rather than that, it could be viewed as two different two different occurrences or instances of the telling of this same story within the book of Genesis, chapters 12 and 15. So that's interesting. But the other thing that's very, very interesting here, that's even more interesting, I want to talk about right now. There's 400 years talked about, and that Abram's seed was to become an alien resident in a land not theirs. That would imply not the promised land, but somewhere else. And we know they were in Egypt, and we have, you know, all the work that we've done, I've done personally, but I'm offering to the world as part of public domain, I'm not seeking copyright, is my articles regarding the world, the ancient history of the Jews, as well as all the nations, but focusing on the Jews. It pertains to 400 years in the sense that we can calculate, in fact, based on the 430 years mentioned in Exodus chapter 12. Is that correct? I haven't even researched this today. I don't know. I don't know if that's correct, but I believe it's Exodus chapter 12 from my memory. Or maybe it's not 12. Maybe it's something else. We shall see. Yeah, it is chapter 12. 12 and verse 40. And the dwelling of the sons of Israel. The sons of Israel, who had dwelt in Egypt, was 430 years. So the sons of Israel had dwelt in Egypt for 430 years. Right. Which is... which is significant. It doesn't say the sons of Abram, it says the sons of Israel. So Jacob, 430 years, if we take the Exodus date of 493, which is 479 years prior to the founding of the temple in 1014 by Solomon, which also was year one of Solomon was 1017, which is also 430 years prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 BCE. 587 plus 430 is 1017, and that's year one of Solomon, and year four of Solomon, 1014 BCE, the temple was founded. Add 479 years to that to get back to the 480th year mentioned in 1 Kings 6 and 1, and we get the Exodus date of 1493. And then when we add the 430 years that Israel spent in Egypt, we get 1923, which is the first year that Jacob took the position of second in power over all of Egypt at the age of 30 years old. So 1923, based on this reckoning, is when officially Israel began to live in Egypt, because Jacob was free out of prison. He was a citizen of Egypt for the first time in 1923. And that was the beginning of 430 years of Israel dwelling in Egypt. 9 years later, Joseph was 39 years old. And that was 1914, when Jacob and his family, all the sons of Israel, moved to Egypt in 1914. But in that year, Levi also was as one of the sons of Israel. He moved also to Egypt in that year, 1914. And he died, it tells us, in either Bible. It doesn't matter which Bible, whether the Septuagint or the New World Translation, either one tells us, if we look at the Septuagint, we're not going to look them both up. I've looked up the other one as well. all the years of Levi's life, or Louis, as he's called here, all the years of Levi's life. Were 137. Now, we need one more thing, and that is, what did Demetrius tell us? What did Demetrius tell us? Demetrius, in fact, was an ancient Jewish historian, but he told us that Levi was born 4 years earlier than Joseph, okay, and we have Joseph being 30 years old in 1923, so add 30 years to 1923, and we have Joseph being born in 1953, which is 30 years earlier, BCE, or the very end of 1954, the very last part of the year of 1954, for the birth of Joseph. So if we take, let's just say 1953, we add 4 years to that, because Levi was born 4 years earlier, according to Demetrius, we then have 1953 plus 4 is 1957, right? Actually, that's my birth year in the opposite side of the common era, but 1957 BCE. Then we take away the 137 years that Levi lived, according to what we just read in the Bible, in the Septuagint. It was in Exodus 6 and 16. Yeah, 6 and 16 of Exodus. Levi lived to be 137. So we just take 1957 minus 137. It's pretty easy, because 57 minus 37 is 20, and 19 minus 1 is 18, so we have 1820. 1820 BCE was when Levi died. So returning to our article here, which is, this is the article Joseph and On, or also called Poseidon. It's the article that we have, another one of my research articles, one of the early ones. After Green, there was Joseph, and then Joseph and On was the third article after Green, inclusive. And this article mentions here, I at that time was not numbering my paragraphs, so there's no way of numbering it. There may not have even been chapter numbers here. Were there? I'm not even sure. No, it was just a long article, I think. But there were no chapter numbers, nothing. But you can search within the article for certain words and find things that way. So it turned out, remarkably, that 1820 BCE is a mirror date to the year 1820 CE, of the Common Era, when the United States passed a law on slave trade, so that from 1820 CE, trading of slaves was punishable by death. So, in the Jewish tradition, though, it was also said that when Levi died, which was in 1820 BCE, we just calculated, the death of Levi, who was the last of the sons of Israel to die, according to Jewish tradition, also. But when Levi died in 1820 BCE, that was the beginning of the Jewish slavery to the Egyptians, according to Jewish tradition. So that's 1820, the beginning of the Jewish slavery, which is in the BCE year 1820, which is a mirror date to the end of slavery, which was declared in America in 1820 CE, the opposite mirror date, that is. Curious. And of course, there were many other things talked about in this section here, because the Israelites returned to Canaan, right? After 400 years, it was said that, we just read that, if I'm not mistaken, in Genesis chapter 15. We pray to Jehovah for him to help us here, because this is not easy to navigate. For the very first time as I navigate this, having prepared it, but nonetheless, the very first time presenting it. Abram, in this way, that is, I presented it in articles, but I haven't presented it in this way before. You see that? In the fourth generation, they will return, right? But also, that was in Genesis 15 and 16. In the fourth generation, they will return, but also, they would be afflicted by this foreign nation, right? In Genesis 15:13, these will certainly afflict them for 400 years. So they would return in the fourth generation, which suggests after 400 years would be the fourth generation, which is not surprising because Abram had his first generation of his first son when he was 100 years old. So 400 years, fourth, meaning sometimes three plus something, some part of the fourth, or fourth can also mean four plus some part of the fifth in the Hebrew language. So we have a beautiful fulfillment here, because in the fourth generation, or 400 years after 1820 BCE, what do we get? 400 years after 1820, we get in the 400th year after that, for example, 1421 looks like a very appropriate year, or perhaps 1422 even, depending on how we calculate these things. But the Jewish years overlap with the BCE years because they go spring to spring, and the Julian years go in the BCE calendar, they go January to January, which is overlapping. But we see that the Israelites returned to Canaan here sometime around 1421, in the sense that their Jubilee cycle began again in 1422, I believe is the correct time for the beginning of their Jubilee cycle, depending on the different ways of accounting it. But there's other ways to even determine this, which is very, very exciting and remarkable, and that is in the book of Ezekiel. Okay, in the chapter 1 of that book. Maybe I didn't look it up. No, I didn't look it up in this particular Bible. But it's the same in both Bibles. I'm going to look at the Septuagint again. Perhaps, or maybe I won't. Because I'll have to go, it'll be harder. Okay, it'll be more complicated. So I will just do it here. I'll just, Jehovah willing, do this in this way. We can do it in either Bible because it's the same in both. Ezekiel chapter 1. It came about in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month. And then verse 2, on the fifth day of the month, that is the fifth year of the exile. So the 30th year is equal to the fifth year of the exile of Jehoiakim, which we know was 597 at the turn of the year, which would be spring. Spring of 597 is the fifth year of the year of the exile. 597 in the springtime, and springtime 5 years later is the fifth year, or 4 years later, depending on how you do it again. So if we take 5 years later, it'd be 597 minus 5 is 592. 592 is then the fifth year of the exile in the Julian calendar. It's about 592 BCE. And then we add 30 years to that, or 29 years, or whatever. Again, right, depending on whether we take 29 or 30, we get, if we add 29 to 592, what do we get? Well, we get 29 minus 8, because or if we'd taken, of course, if we'd taken 593, right? If we'd taken 593 instead for the fifth year, instead of 592, we took 4 years, and then assuming 4 years and some months, it could have been 593. It would have been, and then if we took 29 instead of 30, to be consistent, doing them both 1 year less than what's set, or if we just take the difference between 30 and 5, still a difference of 25, but 29 minus 4 is a difference of 25 too. But 29 years, right, added to 593 would be, it's easy because 93 is 7 less than 100. So it's 29 minus 7, which is 22. So we get, instead of 593, we get 622, as therefore the beginning, the 30th year, right? Or the first of these 30 years, rather, of the Jubilee cycle, would be 622, which is the difference of, again, 25 years between 597 and 622. It's a difference of 25 years, just like the difference between 30 and 5 here in Ezekiel verses 1 and 2 of chapter 1 is also a difference of 25 years. So 622, you know, there are 22 years to get to 600, and then there are three more years to get to 597, so it's 25 total years difference. Just to be thorough about this, I always believe it's important. It always is important to make sure of these things while we're first thinking of them, not to make mistakes in our early calculations. If possible, we don't want to make any mistakes, but especially early on when we're considering things for the first time. So since we're studying this for the first time, I'm being extra thorough. So if we have 622 then as one of the years, either the beginning of the Jubilee cycle, or perhaps it means it's the sabbatical year at the end of the Jubilee cycle from which they reckoned. We don't know. We don't know what the starting point would be, but 522 looks like it's important, or maybe 521. Or 620, and well, 521 would have been also, but Jerusalem was destroyed, so not 522. Jerusalem was destroyed in 587, so it would be 622 we're talking about, because we were going backwards to get to the reckoning that Ezekiel was doing. Yeah, but 522 would have been another one of these Jubilee cycles, because they were every 50 years, which would take another talk in order to prove that. But that's another thing. These Jubilee cycles were 50 years long. Rather than trying to cover everything, we need to assume that for the purpose of this discussion, and we'll prove it later. Or this will prove itself, though. That's the other thing. These things prove themselves in many, many ways. So, you know, wisdom is proved righteous by all its children, Jesus said. So we don't have to worry too much. But 622 is what we're talking about, would have been the previous Jubilee, just prior to the last Jubilee, that is, prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in 587. That was 622. And then we'd calculate back 50 years, 50 years, 50 years, which would be 100 years, 100 years, 100 years if we go in twos. And eventually we get back to 1422, which was Israel in the Promised Land. And that was what we just mentioned, did we not, when we talked about the time period of the beginning of slavery for Israel in Egypt, which was 1820 BCE, right? And slavery was abolished in 1820 on the opposite side of the Common Era in 1820 CE, or some people call it AD, it's the same thing, 1820. In the year 1820, the U.S. abolished slavery. But in 1820 BCE, when we took a period of time 400 years after that, we got to 1421 or 22 or 1420 in that period of time, very close to that period of time. So knowing as we do that these dates may not be entirely exact, you know, to the very year, this is quite a remarkable coincidence here, because Israel was established in taking the Promised Land, of course, in 1452, but the battle and the warfare was fought in 1446, we've already mentioned, when Caleb stood up and made a statement about him at that time, about himself, and the fact that he was 85 years old at that time, and he had been 40 years old when they spied out the land, you know, which was 45 years earlier, in 1491, when they spied out the land. So anyway, which was after the Exodus, by a couple of years, when they spied out the land. So this is very, it all fits together, but the 1446 being the time when Caleb made that statement about the about how old he was, and the context being that they had just made a conquest, a significant number of conquests in the Promised Land had been achieved by that year, 1446 BCE. So that meant that they were in the Promised Land, right, but they hadn't started their Jubilee cycle yet until about 25 years later, it looks like, from that. But there were two traditions, according to this article, Joseph and On. I'm just checking that that's what we're in fact reading. Yeah, right. That's the article. It's an article I wrote very early on. There were two traditions of the Jewish scribes which asserted, one of which, that is, asserted that 33 years passed from the entry into Palestine until the first Jubilee cycle, which should be about right if 1453 minus 33 would be 1420, very close. And 1453 was very, depending on, they crossed the Jordan right around the time of Nisan, so it's very, it doesn't create many problems in the chronology there to say 33 and to say 1453 instead of 1452. Or does it? Wait a minute. Well, no, there's some. It's just that there's some discrepancy. I think, yeah, 1453 would have been 40 years after the Exodus, and 1452 is 40 years and some months after the Exodus, whereas actually 1453 would be 39 years and some months after the Exodus. That's the difference. So this number looks to be slightly off. 33 looks slightly wrong, because it would require 1453 instead of 1452 as being the year that they actually entered by crossing the Jordan. But it says 21 years from the settlement of the land until the first Sabbath. But the first Sabbath would have been starting, if we take 1421 as the start of the Jubilee cycle, they had Sabbaths every 7 years. So 1421 minus 6 takes us to 1415, which is the first BCE year when they had a yearly Sabbath. And if we add 21 years to that, we get 1436, which is approximately 16 years after they crossed the Jordan in 1452. And it's slightly more than the traditional 14 or 15 years, according to the Jewish tradition, when they had completed this settlement of the land. But it's fascinating, because it's quite good agreement here. So that gives us some bit more basis. And there's more information there, but there's one more thing. Just to note that we also believe that Jerusalem fell in 587, not 586, which at the time I wrote this was the date I believe was the fall of Jerusalem. But it's been refined furthermore to be placed now, more accurately, we believe, in 587 BCE for the destruction of Jerusalem. 587, that is. Okay, so that's BCE. So that's today's study. I actually feel pretty good. But I've been a little bit weak. And it's not just because I'm tired. It's more of a weakness because of ill health. It's not really ill health either. I've just been poisoned. It's what it is. It's vitamin D. Too much vitamin D. But I'm not saying anyone else should stop taking vitamin D either. That's not what I'm saying. I think you should listen carefully to your body, but if you're taking a great quantity of vitamin D, then it's difficult to tell people to stop taking it or to slow down because it might be benefiting you greatly. But you need to be attentive, I would say. We all need to be attentive, but anyone who's taking vitamin D needs to be especially attentive to the quantity they're taking, but more especially to the symptoms that they're experiencing and whether those symptoms could indicate a poisoning. But not to be premature about stopping either, but if all the signs indicate it, then it's the problem is, what do you do if you're not poisoned? Because if you just slow down in taking your vitamin D, you might still end up being poisoned, but it might take longer to get to the point of being toxic or having experience of toxicity in your body. So it's not, it seems to me the simplest way is to keep taking it until you experience toxicity that you know is toxic, and then stop altogether and wait until some number of months, or many weeks, or several weeks, like 2 weeks, 15 days is required to decrease or purge. The half-life is 15 days, so half leaves your body. Half the vitamin D leaves your body in 15 days, and then another 15 days, three-quarters of it will have left, because another half of the half would have left. And then another 15 days, so 45 days, a half of a half of a half would be still remaining. Which is about, 12.5% still remaining in your body of the vitamin D. So at that point, whether you want to continue purging or whether you want to start taking it moderate amounts is a very individual thing, I think. I think I want to see what happens when I completely rid my body of vitamin D, which is never possible, but it will be. I want to go. I'll apply to Jehovah in prayer to determine what Jehovah thinks, because I don't really know anything. We never know anything. We always need to pray if we want to know something, because he will give us a better answer than we could get on our own. But I'm believing it's going to be, well, unless something happens, of course. If something happens in the meantime that tells me it's time to start taking vitamin D again, then Jehovah will let me know what that is, and I'll probably be able to do it. And there won't. If I know, there's no problem. But if I don't know, then I might continue until I do know that it's time to start taking vitamin D again. So, yeah, I'm fully functional right now. But I was old before. I was still the same age as I am now, so I wasn't full of vim and vigor, seeing as I had health problems. I could have been, but I didn't have, before I learned about vitamin K2, I didn't have full health. So going back to that time, right now I might be as good as I was then, or better. I'm probably better than I was then, actually. I think I am. Better in health than I was before I started taking vitamin K2. But slightly worse, or significantly worse than I was at the peak of my health a month or two ago, you know, or whenever I was, before I believed that I was, that I'd received a toxic amount of vitamin D. Before that time, that was my peak, absolute peak of health of my whole life almost. I mean, it was, even with all the problems I have, it was still a very high level of health. In the middle of January and February, that was the peak of my winter, of any winter. It was the best winter I've ever had, but it might have been the peak of my health, you know, of all my life. That might have been the peak of my health, but made worse by the fact that it was January and February, of course. So if I can achieve that same level of vigor in the summertime, then I guess that should be my goal, to achieve. I mean, it's I believe an attainable goal to achieve that level of the peak of my health of my whole life, the best health of my whole life, although albeit it's difficult to be confident about that, seeing as I'm as old as I am. But there are many reasons to believe people can be vigorous in old age, with Moses being one excellent example of that. He lived to be 120, and his strength did not leave him until he died. He was strong right up to the end. So, yeah, we have examples to give us faith about that, but also there are modern-day examples, too, of people who are healthy. For example, Norman Walker, the juice promoter, who was very much a believer in vegetable juices and other juices, I believe, too, but possibly anyway, but certainly carrot juice was one juice that he advocated using. And I don't juice carrots myself. I'm just making a note of a modern day example of someone who lived to be healthy into old age up until 99 years of age, as the story goes, anyway, as the records seem to indicate. But I mean, there are people who live longer than that, so, but whether they're vigorous all those years in their health is a different issue. I seem to think that some people are more vigorous than others, even though some people live a long time, they don't necessarily have, in all cases, the same, you know, vigor. Wow, I sure feel good. I mean, I feel, I don't have any lack of energy right now. None. I mean, it's just that when I walk around, you know, I'm not fully, like, I'm not like an 18-year-old when I walk around. I'm not at that level, but maybe it's possible to get back to that. But also, I would have to exercise a lot more to get to that level, too. If I spend more hours sitting down, I'm not going to have the level of, in my feet, and my legs, and my ankles, and all of these parts of my body that give us perambulatory, you know, agility. I won't be at my peak in those things unless I do a lot of exercising, or frequent exercising. So, I mean, but I can still crouch down and work for a certain period of time, crouching down or, you know, kneeling down. I could still do that. And I think the fact that I don't ever really do that, and I could still do it, indicates that a good level, a high level of health is very possibly attainable. But one of the problems with old age, too, is if we get injured, the healing is slower. Anytime we get hurt, the healing is slower. So, for example, I might bounce back from vitamin D toxicity in a certain period of time, and maybe a young person who wouldn't have taken anywhere near the amount, of course, that I did, because the smaller you are, the less you take based on weight. But a younger person who had been similarly, you know, in a relative way, proportionally poisoned to the way I was, that young person might recover more or less quickly, but actually younger people can be damaged more easily in some ways too, because they haven't developed their defense systems in their body yet. So there are dangers. That's why they warn people, young adolescents or even any adolescents, they warn them about the danger of certain types of drugs, for example, because the brain can be affected negatively at an age when the brain is still being formed, when the brain patterns are being formed, and the brain structure is being formed, which can adversely affect the future productivity or happiness or health of that person. So certainly we don't want to use any drugs for that reason. But the reason when we get older, of course, it's not the same, because as we just said, young people are more vulnerable. But it's still just as important to avoid drugs at all ages, of course. That's the thing, because drugs are not, and of course, I mean, the thing about alcohol, we now know more about alcohol too, and alcohol can damage the brain and does damage the brain also. So it's not just drugs, but the ability, it's the importance and the choice and the freedom, you know, that we have. The thing is, people don't realize that they get forced into these things, right? Their freedom's taken away. They become a slave to drugs. They become a slave to alcohol. They become a slave to some part of the world that encourages them to use those substances, and they become slaves, and they're not free. The only way you can be free is if you're free of drugs, you're free of alcohol, you're free of nicotine, cigarette, whatever, all the drugs and all the substances that you can be addicted to. Sugar, being free of that addiction. Caffeine, being free of that addiction. Being free of every possible addiction is part of freedom. And the ability, the power of freedom is truly, it's all-encompassing. It gives you, you know, it's almighty, like Jehovah, right? You can do anything if you're free, if you haven't yet predetermined something. So the freedom from tattoos means you're still free to do anything with your body because you haven't already put some decoration on your body. Free of piercing means you're still free to do anything with your body because you haven't yet done anything to it. So freedom comes, and this is almightiness. That's what comes with being like Jehovah, a God, almighty in power. He can do anything. He's almighty. Which part of which means he might do this, he might do that, he might do this. He can do anything, but you can't do anything if you've already narrowed your choices. And you narrow your choices when you make limiting choices that like, for example, invasive surgery would be an example of something that would limit your choice in the future, right? Or, you know, any time where you alter something irreparably, or, you know, at least with no way of going back, as far as is known, like if there's no technology known that can reverse that process, and there generally isn't for any process a way of reversing it in health, right? I mean, there just isn't. Not completely reversing it. Like, even though vitamin K2 reverses heart disease, does it completely reverse it? So that we get back to the youth that we had when we were 16 years old, or whatever that time was when we attained optimal health. But I doubt that we did actually obtain optimal health at any age, because we didn't know about the vitamins back then. We didn't know about how to get health back then as well as we do now anyway. So the thing is, now is the time. Now is the time to try to get our health. Okay, this is Ward Green. It's March 15th, 2023, according to my my most recent computer displayed date here. And it is, of course, daylight savings time in the Eastern time zone, 1627 hours currently. I love you. I love you dearly. I love you very much, intensely from the heart. I'm going to be saying goodbye for now. Praise God. May God bless you. And may you seek the kingdom of Jehovah in everything you do. And put faith in the name of Jesus, the only name by which we must get saved. And He is God's anointed one, the Messiah, known as Christ to many, and in the Bible, but to many people, He's known as Christ. To some people, He brings great happiness at the mention of His name, and other people, not so much. In fact, many people, it hurts them to hear the name of Jesus, or even to hear the name of God, or to hear the word God. Jehovah is His name, but the word God itself is distasteful to many people who don't believe, because it's just a reminder of how far they've come away from God, and it hurts. So we don't necessarily tell everybody, you know, right up front, God, Jesus, I'm going to talk about these people all the time. We don't announce that to people right up front. We don't have to. We can be discreet about it, as the faithful and discreet slave is. Also, we can be wise in our use of these words, but when we're studying it, it's good to be reminded that Jesus is the Messiah, that He is our friend. He loves us. He actually loves us. And Jehovah loves us so much that He gave Jesus, His only begotten Son, as a sacrifice for the sins of mankind. So, have a wonderful day. Bye for now.